You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. You're about to hear our part two of my conversation with the wonderful Sunita Patel. Our conversation will continue on Neuralinks and how science fiction presents a cautionary tale for national security. But before we get to part two, let's catch up on some national security law news. Reports in major newspapers abroad are saying that Europe does not have sufficient air power in order to protect the eastern flank of NATO. Obviously, this is a serious concern. We're NATO members. And if that's the case, be sure that our enemies have assessed us to have this vulnerability. All right, if that weren't bad enough, it appears right now that Russia may be beating Western countries and securing artillery supplies on the international markets. And this came from the Czech government, which has said that the same companies are being used to provide artillery to both Ukraine and Russia, which is, you know, shocking profiteering if true and not a good look. Prague actually is trying to coordinate some of the purchases from non-NATO countries. And they are really struggling right now to compete with Moscow. And they said that this is a losing battle, that this is just not working out as planned. Certainly, that is not a good place for us to find ourselves at this point in the Ukraine conflict. Now, as of this recording, which is around the lunchtime on Thursday, there is some news out of Rafah, and it's both grim and thought-provoking. There have been mass casualties in Rafah, which, you know, is where Israel pushed into the town of Rafah because they asserted that that's where Hamas was hiding. And it may well be true. What has happened, though, is that Rafah has now been divided into essentially three zones. It's being described as three different worlds. So the east is described as sort of the archetypal war zone. The middle is now described as a ghost town. And the west is considered a congested mass of people living, quote, in deplorable conditions. Nevertheless, it does appear that Israel's focus was in a very specific area in Rafah, which may suggest they knew precisely what they were targeting. So that is an important thing to note. And if you're looking for aerial photos, those can be found in a number of Western publications, including Le Monde English, as well as the Financial Times. They may be available from U.S. publications online as well, including CNN's national security drop-down side. The other thing is, as we've mentioned in prior podcasts, you know, the economy is everything to our national security, and where we stand with respect to China is an important fact. So today, the Defense Department has indicated, apparently, that we're in trouble right now. We're not spending a sufficient amount of money on military research and development. And that is a commentary in the opinion section by David Grompert. And I apologize to David if I'm mispronouncing his name, but he was the acting director of national intelligence between 2009 and 2010. Might be worth looking at some of the things that he's saying in that column. A couple other thoughts right now is that there are elections occurring in South Africa at this time. As you know, South Africa is the one that has brought some of the suits in international courts against Israel. And for the first time since the freeing of Nelson Mandela, it does appear that the African National Congress is losing ground a bit. So it would be interesting to see how this affects sort of strategies in international fora going forward. And what will happen if a coalition government has to be formed there? It's a big country in Africa. It has got a lot of natural resources. And this is actually of strategic interest to the United States and should probably be watched. And then there is a new breakthrough that may also help in our competition with China, and that is in solar power. So this is extremely promising. Interestingly enough, since we've already talked about Israel, this technology may have actually originated in Israel. The technology is discussed in greater detail in the Wall Street Journal in May 30th edition. And it does appear that we're jumping into this new technology, and this may place us at an advantage moving forward. We certainly should be paying attention to this. There are a lot of people who are on the committee who are truly the world's leading experts on the rules regarding the law of war. What's interesting, however, is there's a full commentary in the Wall Street Journal discussing Israel-Hamas and the Law of War. It discusses more precisely whether Israel has violated the law of armed conflict and whether or not Hamas has done so. It is an opinion piece, but nevertheless, it argues pretty persuasively that there have been violations of the law of war, certainly by Hamas, as well as potentially Israel, though there's less sort of shrift given to this, the Israeli side in this particular opinion piece. If this is something that you would like to hear another podcast on, please go ahead and send us a message. We think as we learn more about what has taken place on the ground, that this will be of increasing interest to young lawyers who are interested in pursuing a career in this area. So please let us know. Please reach out with your thoughts on whether that merits another podcast here in the months to come. All right. Thank you so much. And we're going back to my conversation with the wonderful Sunita Patel. All right, let's move for just a second, because this is a national security law podcast. But back when I was talking with Tracy Reynolds, whom I know you know, we were discussing the Lathe of Heaven. We talked about the impact of erasing memory. And this was also among the lessons of Total Recall. So what could be a national security risk for that aspect of a technology if it were available through that technology? And what might be a positive use case? And on a micro level, could it have some therapeutic use cases for people like our armed service members who have PTSD, who need to be able to live lives after that, where they can feel joy?
Oh, I definitely think so. Actually, and this makes me think of a conversation you and I had when we were talking about the idea for this podcast. How can this technology be used for certain world leaders, maybe that aren't aligned with our values, right?
Oh, I'd throw a net over Putin and help that thing get put in there if it would make a difference.
But then conversely, what's the risk? They could use it against us, right?
Well, we never think so, right? That's not how the American brain functions. That'll never happen. It's not coming on shore.
Yeah. I mean, it's like erasing one's memory, it makes me think of what's the point of memories and what relationship does memory have to an individual and their values? I have memories of growing up in Southern California and the memories of...
Let's be specific, right? Huntington Beach.
Huntington Beach. And, you know, those memories really formed who I am today. You know, doing things with my parents, like picking up trash or volunteering for an organization. I wonder if I had different types of memories, what kind of person that would make me, right? If I had experiences where I just became used to, like, stealing things. Does that make me a bad person? And if I then want to become a good person, I have this technology available to me, I can just erase my past. I can see this sort of scenario play out with individuals that are in prison right now. What if they just wanted to erase their past and start new?
So a couple of thoughts on that. One is there are increasing processes to do that. Concerns that I have is this begins to take on the tin of eugenics. And this is where I begin to recoil. We have a criminal justice system which has changed and morphed over the years. Were crimes previously, you know, down to people being punished for being common scolds, are now laughable. But I do think that that borders into the eugenics. And I can see a use situation for this technology where, much like in Lathe of Heaven, everyone becomes the same. And then what's next? Do we have some technology that we discover where then we all look the same? Because, you know, there's discrimination. Let's eliminate discrimination so we all look exactly the same. Ultimately, is that a good thing?
What if we don't want terrorists in the world anymore? And the way to do this is to wipe their memories.
It's an attractive argument, but I think it still is the same issue. I think we still get into the issue of potential eugenics. And I would say this, going back as far as you can in the, you know, early days of the United States, we were destroying property and committing terrorist acts, and we founded the country. And I know, like the country of Israel, they had to do some pretty wild things to establish themselves. So who would define what a terrorist is? Because we know what it looks like right now, right? It's the subjugation of a civilian population as opposed to an occupying military or the like. It's a subjugation of a civilian population to accomplish a political goal. We would like to think we're, you know, we're peace-loving peoples. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about that. And again, I think a better course for humanity is not, you know, the implantation of a neural link in the troubled. And I would submit, when you talk about people in the criminal justice system, I would offer a few things. The first is that about 80% of them suffer from dyslexia. So they have learning differences. Many of them were raised in poverty. In fact, most of them were. And when it comes to terrorists, particularly the people that join the current terrorism groups, many of them were courted online and had problems, whether they were bipolar or acutely lonely and couldn't connect. They were somewhere on the spectrum, otherwise not identified. When we begin correcting this variation in our gene pool, again, it smacks of eugenics.
What if an individual makes that choice for themselves? I mean, I'm thinking about, of course, Quaid in Total Recall.
I have a little concrete example. So when I first started my career, I worked as a defense attorney, and I had a client who was charged with very, very serious offense. And he was very hard to deal with. He was a serial child molester. And every time he got out of prison, he did it again. And one of his questions was, can't they fix me? That is a person who I can imagine, he was interested in chemical castration. He claimed, now I don't know if in the moment of execution, but he did not want to be him. And so I think a person like that would consent. Honestly, having lost every other thing in his life, no friends, no family, no meaningful connections to sick people, you know, who may have found a cause in him, but, you know, no, nothing. I can see a situation where a person like that would say, I'll give this a whirl because it can't be any worse than it is.
And I think, you know, the conversation that you and I are having is so critical and needs to be had about what are the end uses that society is willing to accept, whether it is an individual making a choice for themselves, giving themselves an ego trip to change their identity. We have to have these conversations. What is it that an individual is willing to use the technology for themselves? And what is it that we are okay with, government being okay with, society being okay with from an ethical perspective or from a criminal perspective, national security perspective on this technology?
Yeah. And then what would we do with it? Let's assume, arguendo, that we have a genocider, and there have been many in our history. There seems to be something, some sort of quirk in the DNA that some are, right? The dehumanizing of a whole group of people is as old as time. And we have a leader who says, you know, I don't want to appear before the ICC or ICJ. I agree to have this embedded so that I stop being who I am. I mean, I can't imagine a situation like that. A person with an ego the size of, let's say, Putin's or Xi's or anybody agreeing to Hitler. I mean, they think they're right. So I can't imagine a use application. It's a nice, I mean, in the abstract, yeah, wouldn't that be great? You just, you know, you catch a guy like that, you stick it in, and now, you know, he starts paying his taxes and treats women well. I don't know how that, you know, I don't know if humanity anticipates that. I think that the example that you gave, though, of restoring mobility and cognition really is the most likely use scenario. And I do wonder, when I listen to stories about, you know, crushing mental illness, like extreme schizophrenia, something that has contributed to homelessness, for example, or, you know, full life destruction through no volition and no error on an individual's part. You know, if there were a technology that could fix that, I think that there would be an ethical use case for this. Though, again, it gets into the issues of how anybody would consent who has no control over their mind and faculties.
Yeah. I definitely agree with you that helping to remedy physical and mental issues is a good use case, particularly personally for me, because of my family member. What I am not sure is what others think, right? When Elon Musk talks about a Neuralink, he said that it aims to redefine the boundaries of human capability. I don't know what that means. I don't know what the boundaries of human capability currently are and how we can push past those. Again, I've watched a lot of science fiction movies. Maybe we can fly. Like, what is the human capability that will be magically unencumbered now with this technology.
Well, I mean, tech bros have had a tendency to think that cognitive speed is a big deal. Remember what Steve Jobs said about computers, right? Mm-hmm. It's just your brain sped up, or whatever words he used. Probably was a little crasser than that. You know, what is the value of us speeding up? I'm not sure how that contributes to the common good.
Maybe, you know, the value of us speeding up is to spurn more technology, more innovative technology.
Right. So that it could keep the tech bros in their billionaire status on and on, and they can lounge and have ketamine, you know, and have 11 kids named X and move to Austin where all is good. Right. I don't know. I think the deification of tech CEOs is a national security threat. And I say that unequivocally. Many of these people will go the way of Howard Hughes. And just, you know, in case you didn't know that, he was a big thinker in his day, great scientist, could design airplanes. He did all kinds of things. And then he ended up alone in a hotel in Las Vegas where he didn't clip his nails, cut his hair, and all he ate was ice cream, and clearly had a mental health issue that he was not going to consent to have a neural link. But I just think the deification of tech CEOs is a very serious national security threat. And we're putting too much trust in them, too much dependence in them. When they can shut down a satellite network and interfere with a major battle, this is not a good thing. And when they have the potential to deliver some sort of data into a brain chip, I do not think that that is a good thing. I do not think they should have that level of control over society, and people need to worship them less.
Related to that, you know, we talked a lot about how this technology might have societal benefits, societal harms, national security benefits, national security harms. So what's the right agency to have oversight over technology like this? Is it the FDA? Is it the SEC? Is it CISA? Do we have the right agency to look at this type of technology with all of its potential benefits and harms?
So I don't think we have the right agency for a lot of what we're looking at right now in rapid deployment of new technology. And I don't think any one agency's remit is such that it can deal with all of the issues. But there are a lot of things that are managed coterminously by a lot of federal agencies. You know, we added a lot of federal agencies after World War II, and we got rid of some agencies after World War II. What would that agency look like, and what would its authorities be, Sunita? Have you thought about that? I mean, we could start it, right? We can. I'll take the humanities side.
Yeah, I think we need to bring in some other members of the ABA Skolins Committee. Alex Joel may want to think about this, right? The sort of tentacles that need to be applied to this is privacy, existing national security laws, the National Security Act, right? Let's think about Chips and Science Act.
Chips and Science Act,
right?
Is big.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. As you go forward in life, please pat yourself on the back when I'm not there to do it, because that's a big deal. Darn it.
It's a big deal.
So I don't know what it looks like. And one of the problems right now, I think we have agencies where Congress didn't get involved, right? You know, NSA was an executive created agency. Could we get Congress to go along with anything like this and give it appropriations? You know, I don't know that they could understand it. You know, the way they're behaving right now is just not great.
But isn't that the challenge with all technology and cybersecurity? How do you tell this story in a very easily digestible manner that resonates and shows the impact?
But we've talked a little bit about tech bros for a second. We talked about extreme privatization in the parable of the sower. It gets so bad that there aren't any public schools. You can't call a police officer. Everything is private, right? And in recall, it contributes obviously to a lot of problems with the colonies on Mars. And in fact, it contributes to there being like segregation. Suddenly there's like a slum in an awful area because there are mutations caused by some of the things the company did. And the mutants no longer find their place in society. They become part of this sort of fringe off, really sad sub-city, if you will, where things are going on. But assuming that Musk has the lead in developing this technology, let's talk about him exclusively for a minute. I'm sorry, he's in my crosshairs. I do admire him, I want to say, on a lot of levels. And on a lot of other levels, I just think he needs to be reined in. But are there reasons to think that we should question some of the things that he is saying about the development of this technology?
Oh, definitely. And we should question it because some of the things he's saying are very ambiguous and vague.
In general, he speaks in these very expansive terms. And he's also a dyspeptic guy. You know, he kind of says one thing and then he'll say another and then he backs off. I mean, it depends on whether it's time for an earnings call, right? Or whether he's trying to get that compensation packet through.
Yeah. And going back to that agency, the agency with 10 tentacles that you and I are going to create and Congress is going to support, we have to have a tentacle that respects shareholder information.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah. So that's another tentacle.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure Congress hearing this will immediately take action. I'll just need time to give notice my current job. So if they're going to pull that together this summer, I can see them doing that because they're going to stop talking about people's eyelashes and hair dye. And they're going to get down to the serious business of helping America maintain its primacy in the world. And helping it maintain its moral authority, right? They're on that.
Yeah.
They're on it right now. So apparently, members of Congress apparently have been asking Musk about how he has portrayed certain things. They've said Neuralink's use of animals and testing its implants may have been overstated. By the way, I wish we could never use animals, love animals, never eat them. That sounds awful. But this is obviously raises questions. And again, CEOs... You know, they've got to deliver on, it's shareholder value, right? ROI, return on investment, perfect truths at all times. I don't know. Anyway, would you like to say anything else about Neuralink?
I actually do want to say one thing that we didn't actually get to. And
let's hear it.
It's the 1966 novelette that Total Recall was based on.
Oh, yes. Yes. And it was very, was it a novelette? It was awfully short. I remember it as a short story. And then this guy died young. Was it Philip K. Dick?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a young guy.
Yeah. It was a very short story, all of 19 pages. And it was called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, if our listeners want to go out and find it and take a read. But, you know, like so many movies that are based on books, there were a couple of differences between the novelette and the movie that I think are pretty relevant for this discussion and also kind of further point to some issues. So the novelette went to really great lengths to describe how miserable the main character, who was known as Quail in that novelette, was in his daily life. He was just absolutely miserable, and that incentivized him to go to a company like Recall. When we're having this conversation, we really have to think about the human that is impacted and driven to take advantage of this technology, who will also eventually be called upon to consent to it, right? If they want it. There's also other differences, like the idea of grafting a false memory over a real memory. And then what really stuck in my head is Recall's arbitrarily deciding to erase an existing memory in order to make space for that memory that Quail bought, and law enforcement tracking Quail using implanted teletransmitters.
Yeah, he got over that. Remember, he wrapped a wet towel on his head, and that took care of everything. Like, yeah, that'll work.
We always try to find a way to mitigate these risks, right?
It was written in the 60s. Okay. What else was different? I'm trying to remember because I feel like the movie was really based on a couple of Philip K. Dick, but maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I remember is there was more than one story that they sort of combined, I think, to come up with that. But yeah, his life was miserable, but that gets to the issue. You know, desperate people are willing to take desperate measures, right?
Yes.
You know, we live, me inside the Beltway, you, I assume, inside the Beltway, and we live well. But if we were starving or we had to deal with a leader like Maduro, wouldn't you pick up your kids, take them out of school, and get the heck out of Dodge? Mm-hmm. And so the more desperate I think you are, the more willing you would consent to things that are highly risky. Right? Like crossing the Rio Grande, doing anything that's just dangerous. You're willing to do it to achieve a better life. Now, in this case, that particular part wasn't that persuasive in a sense that, yeah, he had a bad life in the sense that it was boring. He wasn't challenged in his job. His wife didn't like him at all. That was clear.
He had to push the coffee machine button every day.
He had to push the button, and that's so hard. But so desperate people will try desperate things. And I think this gets back to my, you know, anecdote about my client who was desperate to not be a child molester and hated himself, but felt a compulsion really that he didn't think he could control. And whether he could or he couldn't, I don't know, but he believed he couldn't control that. And he was desperate. So would that take advantage of people who are poor, who are new immigrants, for example, who have medical conditions that they feel will result in their families, for example, being broke?
Mm-hmm. Put that in the ethical considerations box that we need to talk about.
Yeah. What would you add to that?
No, I mean, I don't think I'd add anything more other than, yes, we do need to talk about this. We need to talk very broadly about the impact to society writ large for today and tomorrow.
For today and tomorrow. But I would add one other thing here, because if these groups manufacturing this become very powerful, what happens or tends to happen in the United States, and we've seen this recently, is he who has the most money to donate to PACs, super PACs, and can have the greatest amount of political influence, often gets the most favorable legislation. And that is not a good thing, but that is the point that we have come to in this country. And it's not necessarily a good one. Case in point, Donald Trump was always against TikTok. He was always against TikTok. And then Urs, whatever that guy's name is, who gives him so much money, he was among the chief investors in TikTok in the United States. And when he threatened to pull funding for Trump, Trump said, well, we've got to look at this. And so that was kind of an interesting pivot.
You know, because if we want to unlock the human potential and the capability, what if this technology can innovate in a manner to make people younger?
Wait, you think we have climate issues right now, honey? I mean, you know, so yeah, we can control life. Then we're God, right? You know,
then we can't poke at anybody for being too old.
Yeah. Is that the way to solve it? I know that they need people like you who think about this stuff to be looking at it very closely at a policy level. A pleasure to have you. I know you have to come back next time because we haven't talked about The Matrix. So you're not going to.
More of my favorite movies.
Yes, you and my son. All right. We're going to sign out right now. We're being helped today by the amazing, to be amazing, we've just met him, Angus Whitworth of London, actually from not far from where I lived as a child. We're delighted to have him. He's got a very Scottish name, Angus, and we're very glad he's here. Angus, would you like to say something at all before we wrap up this podcast? Have you anything to say on behalf of the Brits?
I'll see you all for high tea.
There you go. All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend and discuss any topics we've covered in a thoughtful way. Don't be a jerk. Be nice to each other. Listen to each other, for crying out loud. Hear other people's opinions and arguments. It'll improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country more diverse, not just in terms of our skin color, but because diversity is in our thoughts as well. Our writer and producer and host is me. I'm always here in my individual capacity, just like the lovely Sunita Patel. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham of Brooklyn, a lovely person as well. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon. She can dance, deliver a Shakespearean soliloquy, and balance two plates on poles at the same time. Holly, as well as all the members of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.